time for hour number two of the Bible study. The Ask the Pastor Hour, open phones at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our guest in this hour is a native of India. He's also a professor here at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, been on our program many times in the past. He is Dr. Victor Raj, Concordia St. Louis, and very relaxed, very kind of laid back because he's on sabbatical. Are you all rested and relaxed, Pastor?
Sabbath is rest. So.
Or are you working on a book or something and tearing your hair out?
That's the goal and the dream, and it's coming along.
Can you tell us what you're writing about, or is it a big secret?
I don't have a title yet. The publisher has to decide what the title is going to be. It's the struggle that I'm going through, representing the United States on pluralism. That's the mouthful.
Wow.
Yep.
Now, is this a... Is this a theological work that you're putting together?
I'm hoping I can write it something to a 10th grader so he understands or she understands. I've been intrigued by it and enthused by it, and because I'm on sabbatical, I just am doing a few things which I have not done in 30 years. I just walk around, drive around, go see people in strange places, including bookstores, laundromats, dentist office, and just listen. And I have reason to go to these places. And then these years, especially these months, especially since I started doing some quote unquote research on spirituality in the United States, I actually strike a conversation that is not normal to me, but I have gotten into that mode and I'm enjoying it.
So you're doing research,
right?
It's kind of anecdotal research. Is that what it is?
I have substantive research going on in the basement of the library of the seminary, and I have kind of a relaxed kind of research going on in my office as I read books and put a few things on the computer. Then I have this offhand, shorthand, experiential research as I just got into this only about a month ago. This kind of what I call experiential research. And I'm trying to think, and I have sufficient data now to confirm that what I do academically and what I'm confronted by academician is practically done in Main Street or in the little places that where people, ordinary people, congregate. That's an interesting. So my challenge now will be to put some of those academic things into a language that Main Street people are used to and able to make sense out of. That's the struggle I said I'm going through.
I have a question for you.
All right.
I don't know if you'd be able to answer this or not if you've been paying attention to this area of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But there seems to be an economic dynamic underway, a macro dynamic, if you will, which I'm not an economist. So, and I know you're not either, but you're familiar with the nation India.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that in the West, where prosperity has been present in places like Western Europe and in North America, there's a shift underway. And the large populations of China and India, where there has not been a lot of prosperity, but there seems to be an emerging prosperity, have been identified as, excuse me, future competitors to countries like the United States. A lot of products that we have in this country are coming from China. We're importing them. Same thing for India. Is India an emerging economic giant? Could India or could China or the two of them supplant a nation like the United States when it comes to economic power in the world?
I will try to answer the question because the word economy and United States and China and India are now put on the same page, which is, in my opinion, a pretty new thing. The thought that comes to the average person's mind in the United States, and that I can substantiate that especially these days, on the basis of my experience on Main Street, the assumption the average person in the United States has about India is that India is poor. India is poor in what sense? Of course, dollar-wise, economy-wise. On the other hand, on the many, many other hands, one of them being that many searchers of spirituality from the United States, for that matter, from the West, have found India to be rich in spirituality. So now we are talking about economy because of the downturn that American economy has taken, and for that matter, world economy has taken. In that context, China was already playing its significant role, has been, with the relationship China has struck with the United States, or vice versa. It has been going on. You're right. When you go to Walmart or Kmart or Macy's, you pick up a shirt. It's usually assembled in Indonesia, yeah. Tailored in India, and made in Japan. And that's so clear. I'm not a consumer analyst myself, but as I look at these brand names, under each brand name, there is a machinery either in the in China or in Malaysia or Singapore or India that actually does the job. So market economy, individualist capitalistic economy in the United States runs through showrooms, but the underpinnings of what you see in the showroom is happening elsewhere. It's manufactured, definitely, with U.S. money, but with foreign hands. So in this context, how is the economy going to play out? India has been. China was already has been a superpower. India is identified as a major player in the 21st century economy, and there is enough credence to that claim, because you already heard that I'm off to India, the place where I grew up, in 4 days. Actually, we leave Friday, the 27th, and come back on April 11th. Every year as I go, which I am privileged to go, I see dramatic change happening.
For the better?
For the better for some people, might I insist, for some people. On this air, more than once I have said, quoting others, that India has the second largest middle class population in the world, second only to the U.S. And I did some research on this, and about a month ago I read that 300 million Indians in India have a lifestyle that is matchable to the average middle class lifestyle in the U.S. They have refrigerators, if you will. They have they own their home. They're not mortgaging, own their home. They have more than one automobile. All their children are bound to go to college, and husband and wife hold jobs and things like that. So there is that infrastructure solidly built for 300 million. We are talking about 25% of the Indian population. To have a middle class life, so it is there, and as much as there is a middle class and there is education being upfront as the top priority for these families, there is credence to claiming that this will be substantial. It will go on for quite some time.
So, for you, I guess you're like a citizen of the world. I mean, you
in a sense, right.
I'm sure you have an Indian identity,
mm-hmm.
a kind of a loyalty to the nation India. You're an American citizen, are you not?
We are.
So,
I am, yeah.
So
my family is.
I'm sure that you have the blood of the patriot as far as the country of your citizenship.
I pledge allegiance to that.
And when you watch India from a distance, you know, where is your heart? Are you pulling for that country to continue to grow, to increase its middle class, or do you care? Is it just such an enormously populated country that there are plenty enough things to worry about here in Concordia Seminary without spending a lot of time worrying about India? How do you view it?
I try to to view this globally for two reasons. One, with a U.S. passport now holding as I am in my hands, I have become a world citizen because I can travel to, I think, more than two-thirds of the world, at least for a short time without a visa, which I could not do with an Indian passport. So I see that. So I have the benefit of the first world citizenship in terms of travel, interaction with other countries, nations, etc. That is there. As you mentioned, Chuck, my heart is, to a great extent, still Indian because I, as my children, I have three sons, and when they are in deep waters, in my opinion, they exploit my Indianness. Yeah, so I benefit as well as I struggle. So, as a place I left behind, the home that shaped me and formed me, I first came to the U.S. when I was almost 25 years of age. So I was actually formed there. My heart does go out. And in the recent visits that I've been making, which is no longer than 21 days annually, sometimes as short as 10 days, I see only one segment of the Indian population, pretty much the middle class. My church is definitely in the lower middle class to the poorest of the poor. That's how Christianity has been and continues to be that. And as I landed Mumbai or New Delhi and drive out of the airport, I already begin to see, even at the airport gate, I see poverty and affluence kissing each other.
What can you tell me about, in like a paragraph about Mumbai?
Oh, can you
describe it for me?
I am getting used to it myself, Chuck. Yeah. I grew up pronouncing the city as Bombay, and the place I grew up is the southernmost city in the little peninsula. It's called Trivandrum. I'm used to saying it that way, but my place of birth is now for the last 15, 20 years pronounced. It has been known this way by the record, but it is now pronounced as Thiruvananthapuram.
I'll leave that one with
you. Yeah. And I will try. Tourists do this better than I, myself, who was born there, because I was used to the other one. So, 20 years ago, maybe more than 20 years ago, there was a resurgence of nationalism. You know, India was ruled by the British for 200 years, and India became independent in 1947. And gradually, India is discovering its own Indianness, trying to avoid some of those words which are Western. By the way, a car is translatable, but no average illiterate person calls a car by any other name. Computer, telephone, bulb, coffee, those things are Indian words. But, I mean, there is some true credit needs to be given to the people who try to rediscover. Yeah.
Are you a moviegoer?
Tell me more about it.
Do you go to the movies for entertainment ever?
No, not much.
Did you see Slumdog Millionaire?
I did. I had to.
Did you run right out and see it right away?
Yes, we had two of our three sons home, and the day it was released, I believe we were the second group that went in to Ronnie's Theater and see it. It's so realistic, yes.
Is it, you know, for a person like myself who can count what I know about India on one hand pretty much, is it a fair representation of India, its culture, its people?
If you recall the audience and us here, if you recall City of Joy, and how did that come out as a movie? Yeah, I think it was a book as well as a movie. Like that was a story built in and around Calcutta, a rickshaw guy pulling rickshaw. It represented the actual life in Calcutta, in my opinion, because I've seen Calcutta 25 years ago, 30 years ago I've seen Calcutta. It was real. This one, Slumdog Millionaire, is even more realistic than City of Joy. This is set in Mumbai, which is probably, what is it? It's 18 million or more residents, 50 miles in radius, if we can somehow measure this place. Mm-hmm. And I'm told that close to 3 million people commute to this city by electric train, and they have their own little cohorts and groups that they just play cards and listen to music and talk about politics, an hour and a half long one-way ride to work and then back. So it's a metropolitan place. So with that one, with the international airport and the high-rise apartments and five-star hotels, you see white-collar culture. At the same time, you see real poverty. And the Lutheran Church has our own mission there. We still call it, although we started the work in 1952, we still call it a mission field.
Mm-hmm.
And the pastors there, I know three of them pretty personally. They have taken me around the city and showed me four levels of life. Four levels of life.
In Mumbai.
So coming back to the Slumdog Millionaire, I believe I can almost visualize the setting where this was shot. I believe this is representing the third and the fourth tiers of Mumbai.
Is there
existence.
A way for you to describe these four levels?
Yeah,
the four levels.
The top level will be the high rise apartments, connected homes, American style.
Yeah.
And they actually
rich people.
Yeah, they actually cost you millions of dollars to live there. And the second level is your own private homes and reasonably well done, carpeted, air conditioned.
Middle class.
Yeah. The third level is, you have a home, but you don't have a home. That is usually single people, sometimes even couples. They migrate from other places, other parts of India. They come and settle there because Mumbai gives you opportunities for employment. They actually live makeshift in this one so-called apartment. So Victor Raj gets in there for 8 hours of sleep. Then he gets out and goes to work, and the other 8 hours, he finds some park or some bar to entertain himself.
Mm.
And the other guy, Chuck, comes in and sleeps 8 hours, and then he does the other 16 hours elsewhere. That's the shift. Makeshift.
Do we have a corresponding kind of experience in the United States?
I don't know. Maybe the new immigrants might have it in some places. It is more than me renting an apartment in my name and letting you and Mr. X, Y,
and Z. Could we call the second level upper middle class and this level lower middle class?
Much lower middle. Yeah, lower.
Yeah,
lower middle class. Because some of these may be even paying income tax, and they're not that poor.
Okay.
Then
yeah.
The fourth level, we'll get to that, yeah.
The fourth level is?
They don't have a place to call home. Well, it is usually that the ideal representation of the fourth level is the constant influx of immigrants.
Is this the poverty level?
It's the poverty level. You just come from immigrants. I'm talking about people from other states and other towns coming to this place of opportunity, the city of opportunity. They come and they have no place. They have no street address to claim. So
Slumdog Millionaire. Which of the four categories?
The fourth.
The fourth. It's a rich.
Yeah. The first from the bottom.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
the lowest.
Yeah, it's the lowest. And the high rises you see in that movie are real.
So when you talk about a slum in India, slums like we have in the United States, worse?
It is much, much worse.
Much, much worse.
Yeah, you had to go to at least Haiti or Africa to even come closer to what a slum is. Slum is dirty. In this case, the fourth level needs some description here because you have no street address, you have nothing. You go and actually occupy a curb.
So this movie is about going from level four to level one.
Correct. Because of intelligence. This guy had if you watch the movie, watch it
online. See, I always wait till it comes on a satellite.
Yeah. That's fine. And I don't want to give the theme out. What happens in the Slumdog Millionaire movie is this guy as the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire series. That's actually what's happening there. India has played it several times. India has done this game several times. And this guy was selected to be a person who would be interviewed. And he will be asked questions. I think there are like 12 points there. For each of these points, he answers correctly. Why? How? Because of his experience in the slum.
Hmm.
For each question, including there was a question about Three Musketeers, he was able to answer that. Yeah. And he has either encountered somebody who was learned through his experience, or he has lived, and suddenly there's a flashback. Once the question is posed, flashback. Oh, he relates that to that so quickly in 30 seconds, recalls and gives the right answer.
I'm gonna see this movie based on Dr. Rogers' recommendation here. Let's take a call before we get to the bottom of the hour. Hi, Leo. You're on the Bible study. Good morning.
Good morning, Professor. Rather, Dr. Rogers. So we're a real joy to hear you talk. More than 50 years ago, I was on the staff of the College of Education at Carbondale at SIU.
All right.
A sizable international component there, and really some internationally important people like Charles Skinner and Counts, George Counts, so forth and so on.
Huh.
One day, on the way to work, I heard a broadcast by Harry Reasoner, and he was saying one of the problems with Americans is we tend to conclude that everybody's exactly like us.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about India and Pakistan at that time, and we had a student who was the headmaster of the John Dewey School in New Delhi, who happened to be Islamic, and one of his friends from Pakistan, who was also in the doctoral program there, and we speculated about the unfortunate lack of opportunity for exposure to things more intellectual, that they may be stuck in a rice paddy up to their knees, and they had the intellect of a genius. And I'd be interested in your experience in thinking about that sort of quality of these incredibly gifted and peaceful people by and large. We sure appreciate your broadcast, sir.
All right, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much. Very interesting question, a very interesting observation here, because you have seen hands-on people who have come to the United States to make the most of the opportunities they are given. Let me back this up with a few comments that I already started mentioning about the Indian middle class. I did some research on this because as I become citizen of the U.S., I was reflecting on what's happening. And India has, as I mentioned earlier, 300 million people who are in that middle class sector. And it is with the middle class that there is some mobility in the social life taking place. All others are pretty much settled in where they were born. In fact, Chuck, I do own property back home. I inherited from my parents. Had I not become the U.S. citizen, it would have been my dream to go back and retire there.
Uh-huh.
I am one of 8 siblings, and none of us would want to sell our property to anybody else. If we moved out, we would sell it to one of the siblings, even for a cheaper price.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how social society...
Keep it in the family.
Yeah. Society is well-knit. I think 100 years ago, the U.S. people also did that. But with the 300 million, this has caused a lot of mobility in the society. However, 78%, and this is again the number I got in January, early in January, 78% of these so-called mobile middle class still want to settle back in their fatherland. They want to go back to the village or town where they were raised, even though they will be going to all these metropolitan cities to work and so on. And 64% of them are intentional about educating their children more than they are.
Mm.
So I believe with that structure, American or global economy already sets in, has already set in. 25 years ago, I had to have hard cash in my pocket to buy anything, including to check into a hotel. But today, I can almost buy a cup of coffee in India with plastic.
You're listening to the Bible study. We're talking with our guest, Dr. Victor Raj, native Indian and a professor here at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, and we'll be right back.
All Christians are happy to hear that their sins have been forgiven because of the work of Jesus Christ. However, not all Christians take joy at hearing that the sins of those with whom they are angry are also forgiven. The next long gospel will talk about that as we learn about Zacchaeus.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
The St. Louis Symphony Orchestra joins orchestras across the U.S. in an effort to relieve hunger with a national food drive. At Powell Hall, March 27th and 29th, your canned food donations will help Food Outreach provide nutritional support for hungry families. Especially appreciated are canned tuna, turkey, chicken, salmon, corn, green beans, mixed vegetables, mandarin oranges, pineapple chunks, and peaches. See slso.org for additional information.
What do lizards have to say? Find out on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moment host, Ian Taylor.
Since God is the author of all language, we shouldn't be surprised to find many and varied forms of communications among the creatures he has made. The recent discovery that even lowly lizards communicate with one another has offered several surprises for those who believe we evolved. Yet, in analyzing over 1,500 displays by sagebrush lizards, researchers say that there is no question that they are communicating with one another. Lizard communication is a complex body language that follows a recognizable rules of grammar. It is made up of three parts, which include head bobbing, push-ups, and leg motion. Mixing and matching one or more of these actions results in over 6,000 possibilities. But what do lizards say to one another? Repeated observations have convinced researchers that they can interpret what the lizards are saying to each other. Much of the communication is used to woo a mate. Lizards will also brag to other lizards when they find a particularly good rock. But a lizard may also warn another lizard who might want to share his rock. Not only is such complex communication among lowly lizards not expected by evolution, but researchers noted that the pattern of communication over separated populations does not follow expected evolutionary patterns. Yes, even the lowly lizard glorifies its creator.
For a free copy of our Creation Resource Catalog, visit our website at creationmoments.com or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. That's 1-800-422-4253. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
I'm Diane.
I'm Roland.
On the next afternoon show, 3 to 6 on AM 850 KFUO.
You know, since Christianity seems to be in a crisis, I thought maybe Hank Hanegraaff would be a good person to talk to about that.
He's got a big book, big, thick book about that. So
lots of learning.
We'll talk about that. Jill Savage, Real Moms, Real Jesus as well, as we consider being a mom and being a Christian.
You didn't say real cheeses, did you?
No, Jesus.
Oh, Jesus. I'm sorry.
3 to 6, the afternoon show on AM 850 KFUO.
The Contemporary Christian Music Ministry, presenting the 18th annual production of The Promise at Zion Lutheran Church, 1301 North State Street in Litchfield, Illinois. Performances for this musical drama based on the life of Christ, March 20th, 21st, 27th, and 28th at 7 p.m., and March 22nd and 29th at 2 p.m. Friday, March 20th is designated as Youth Group Pizza Night. The Promise at Zion Lutheran Church, Litchfield.
Well, I wonder if you saw the movie Slumdog Millionaire. It won, I think, 8 Academy Awards here in the recent Academy Awards. And I haven't seen it. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm one of those guys who sees these movies in the comfort of my own living room on my television set when they come around on the satellite. Mm-hmm. So the movie does not westernize. And I don't see how it can. It's produced by Indian people, but you never know. If you want to try to make money in the United States, I suppose you could kind of westernize your movie or your plot. Is it does not do that?
The producer and the scriptwriter both are British, I believe. In spite of which, I insist, in spite of which, this is an Indian movie. I don't know how much makeup had to be put on any of these personalities. And I cannot even imagine that they had to do a lot of artificial setting shooting for this movie. This is just hands-on, right off the cuff. You just pulled your camera, you had your cast set, and you just threw them out into that real natural setting. And that, if you're going to watch the movie, I don't want to steal the thunder, but a lot of that is so realistic, in my opinion. It's also a true-to-life story that actually happens. It's a daily occurrence in metropolitan cities, in any place elsewhere in India as well. There have been some negative criticism coming from India. One was there was even a huge demonstration, I think, just about when this, prior to the winning of these 8 Emmys, there was a demonstration in some parts of India against the word slum dog.
Is that a common word in India, or where does that come from?
This is the slum dweller, slum dog. Dog is kind of it's the dog part that offended a lot of people who were fighting against this expression. I think the thesis of the movie is that the people who live in the slums actually live. I should back this up, because a dog is not a pet as the average American knows. You know, my family had, I think they still have in India, have two dogs. We have a kennel outside the house.
Yeah.
We have a spacious home, and it is reasonably kept neat. And once a dog enters my living room, no, it has no place there, not to speak of my lap or anything. Okay, you may have your pets, and that's a different story. But the two dogs that we have at home, they are domesticated. They're not wild, but they have a kennel outside.
Now, how many people?
Yeah.
How many people in India?
Yeah.
Now, there are what? How many hundreds of millions?
Oh, 1.2, I think.
1.2
billion.
Billion people.
Yeah. It hit the mark 1 billion by 1999.
I hear that, what, we have 6 billion people in the world, something like that.
Yeah.
So India has about a fifth of the people in
Correct.
The world.
Yeah.
If you're an Indian, are you saying to yourself, boy, we gotta cut our population down here? Or are you thanking God for your, or whoever you thank in India for, the birth of a child, or... Are you proud of your population over there and want it to be bigger, or how do they view it?
Chuck, I get a difficult question. Two things I'll say. There is a global civilization, global culture, and global middle class. India is very much a part of that. 300 million. That leaves us with about 800 to almost 900 million who do not fit that category. And out of the 900 million, 50% of the 900 million, 450 million, live below the international poverty line. I don't know what the international poverty line is. It's not even a dollar a day. Okay, that's one part of it. And for the middle class, the goal is to educate, they are themselves educated, and to educate their children. Education, for the most part, until you go to professional schools, is pretty much free. Thanks to the socialistic nature of the country. And go on.
I'm grasping here to imagine Mumbai, 18 million people in a city. When we talk about the St. Louis area here, including its suburbs, it's the larger metropolitan area. It's about, I think, 2.5 million people.
2.5 million times six.
I can't imagine all these people trying to get in and out of the city on trains, all that kind of thing, and then 450 million people, which is larger than the population of the United States, 450 million people who are living under the poverty line. Now, so I have a population question for you, and how you see it as a man born in India, because I got two stories to compare here. One of them is from the Associated Press. This is actually from last week, and the headline is "More babies born in 2007 than any other year in United States history."
Mm-hmm.
We talk about the baby boom, the post-war baby boom, but it turns out that 2007 was a record setter. More babies born in the United States than any year in American history, topping the peak during the baby boom 50 years earlier, according to federal researchers. There is both good and bad news from the more than 4.3 million births. The U.S. population is more than replacing itself, which is a healthy trend.
Mm-hmm.
However, the teen birth rate was up for the second year in a row. Now, I have another story over here. This comes from the United Kingdom. This came out on Sunday, and it was written by a guy by the name of Jonathan Leake. He says, and keep our names straight here, Jonathan Porritt, who is one of Gordon Brown's leading green advisors, meaning environmental issues, not money, is to warn that Britain must drastically reduce its population if it is to build a sustainable society. Porritt's call will come at this week's annual conference of the Optimum Population Trust, otherwise known as OPT, of which he is patron. The trust will release research suggesting the United Kingdom population must be cut to 30 million. Think about this. We're talking about 1.2 billion people in India. They want to cut their population to 30 million people if the country wants to feed itself sustainably. Porritt said, quote, population growth plus economic growth is putting the world under terrible pressure. Each person in Britain has far more impact on the environment than those in developing countries, so cutting our population is one way to reduce that impact. Now we're all over the board here. We have 450 million people living in abject poverty in India, which has the second largest middle-class population in the world. We have the United States, arguably the most prosperous country in the history of the world, having more babies born in 2007 than in any other year in its history. And then we have the United Kingdom that, I don't know how you do this, wants to reduce its population to 30 million. Do you have any wisdom to share in this rather chaotic population question?
Thanks for the word chaotic, so I don't need to have wisdom because my wisdom will not work. I'm wandering all over the place. What's the U.S. population now? 320 million?
Yeah, I think
I cannot put my finger onto the exact year. I am saying that since the 70s, 34 million new immigrants have come to the United States. I read that about less than a month ago. Since I became a citizen, I'm keeping time. Yeah, so, and I'm assuming out of the 34 million, at least 30 of them came from non-Western countries. Okay, this is still the land of opportunity. And my earliest caller mentioned about the brilliant young people in India, et cetera, which is all true. So that's phase one of my boiling mind here. And the dream of the world, in spite of communism and individualism and socialism, etc., the dream of the world is still the American dream, to discover oneself and maximize his or her potential and live the best life possible. And even the 450 million people in India, they cannot dream much. At least in their dreams, there is a desire. So one of them, should one of them become a millionaire or a billionaire, they will rejoice. And I jumped so quickly to India. I'm going to hop to China because the population explosion is the major issue here, okay? In China, I am told, I had a colleague like 15 years ago in Concordia, Mequon, who said you could only have one known pregnancy for a couple. Not just one child. If the government knew that your wife was pregnant the second time, that would be illegal. So that's one way of enforcing birth control. Okay, I'm not talking about the birth control measures in the U.S. China is communist, at least by the book. India is socialistic, and might I say, I dare say, spiritual. My college days, late 60s into early 70s, this was there on almost any car you saw, or the truck, lorry, we call them. There were bumper stickers. We are two, we have one. India, I think, legalized abortion, on certain categories, etc. India had introduced birth control already in the 60s and so on. It has been insisting on limiting your procreation. Where does it work? It works with the middle class. Like, I hate to say this over the radio, but I think our United States population explosion happens in inner cities and among the poorest of the poor. Was it, again, this year there was a number that I saw that 51% of American children under 5 years of age are white. 49% are from other races. But the broader sociological studies will tell you that whites are not in any way near reproducing as Hispanics, Blacks, Asians, etc. So those things. So the British line is applies, and it does make sense. It does make sense to me. It does make sense to a middle class thinker. India has, I don't know, the best or the worst, maybe both, of middle class thinking, affluence, poverty, spirituality, and all of the above. So the economist and the political analyst and the population scientist will tell you that it's not good that you have too many children. And I know that from experience. My dad and mom raised 8. And my dad, when he died 19 years ago, said, no debts, no enemies, no unfulfilled commitments. I won't be able to say that. I'm only raising 3. So that's the lifestyle that is changing. And the explosion, population explosion, takes place among the poor, the illiterate, folks who already do not have a home, folks who cannot feed themselves. That's where the population takes place. So the book knowledge, the scientific knowledge is limited, and it benefits the informed and, might I say, the educed, not the others.
I wonder if, I don't know if we can pull these things onto the same stage here, but I'm going to try and see what you think. I wonder if this population discussion we're having can be put under the microscope and looked through the lens of what the Bible says. God says in Genesis to Adam and Eve, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, something like that. And here we are in the 21st century, and certainly they've been multiplying in India to the tune of 1.2 billion people. But is that good if 450 million people are in abject poverty? Here in the United States, the news is last week that we are replenishing at least enough to grow our population so that it's not shrinking. But along the way, we aborted about 50 million of our brothers and sisters, which is not good. And now in England, and I didn't go through the whole story here, but it seems to me that if you're going to have your population fall down to 30 million people, you're going to have to pass some legislation. And that legislation is going to have components that take away what we have otherwise known to be freedoms, sort of the way it is in communist China. Now, is this all just the business of an ever-industrialized world and birth control and abortion and only one pregnancy and all that kind of stuff, the way man manages the population question? Or is God looking down from his throne at India and China and America and England and shaking his head in disgust or condemnation or, I don't know, ambivalence as to how we address this question?
Chuck, you put me on the spot. You don't usually do this.
Well, I'm just asking for your best guess. I know that you have the answer.
I'm going back to the Garden of Eden and thinking at this time only of stewardship. I hope my colleagues will forgive me. Adam and Eve, as much as I know, had only 2 children.
Well, they had Cain and Abel, and then there was Seth, I think.
Yeah,
one of them was murdered.
Right,
and
they had the whole world.
Right.
They had the whole world, if not even if they had 100.
And you and me.
Yeah, and you and me. So that's the model. We don't have to have 11 children as my grandparents on both sides had, and maybe you had a history like that years ago too. Centuries ago.
We have like 2. I got to go way back to find somebody with a bunch.
Yeah, so if I would have my son's wedding done in India, I'll be entertaining close to 800 people. Yeah. So this is a one-time event, etc. So,
I want to have a big cake.
Though. Right. Yeah, things like that. But I think I'm coming back to the fundamental principle of stewardship. And I'm... When I talk stewardship, I am talking past the head of 4 billion people in the world. Okay, and this is a challenge, and stewardship works if it works among the informed. That's again a challenge, and if the informed, if the well-to-do, if the people who are educated, if the people who are politically conscious of the sociological and economic and other ramifications of an escalating population, then they need to be punished. They need to be arrested and put in prison. And I cannot go to the other details of that at this time. But the challenge is, this is a good goal. When India said 30 years ago, we are two, we have one. It's a good goal. It's good public preaching. And it clicks with people who are, might I say, middle class, and they are conscientious, and they will, against my wish, they'll go through abortion, and they will do this and that, and that's another issue altogether. But in spite of this publicity given to we are two and we have one, the bulk of the population, especially those who live in poverty and below the poverty line, are simply not able to adjust to that vision. I'm not absolute about it, but as much as their situation and their thinking goes, it doesn't click. They probably have other things going on in their mind. Even among that category of people, there are candles lit occasionally. There's a man or a woman, a few here and there, who actually see the vision and practice this kind of stewardship and come up. And they automatically, this is probably true in the United States too, they automatically move from the poverty, below the poverty line, to the middle class, and then resettle themselves in some other part of the country.
Let me make sure that I'm understanding you.
Yeah.
If I hear you correctly, you're saying that it is appropriate for a society to regulate itself and discourage just octomoms, mm-hmm. you know, in their presence.
Yeah.
Because it's appropriate from a stewardship perspective to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't mean to put you on the spot here. I mean, I just, you know.
It helps me thinking. Yeah.
Every once in a while I have a question that occurs to me.
Right.
Because it does not seem that unrestrained procreation, replenishing the earth,
mm-hmm.
is necessarily always a good thing if 450 people, million people have to live on a dollar a day.
Mm-hmm.
But then I don't know that the Bible, well, there we are. If it is a stewardship question, and I can see where it is, it also threatens then to become a tyranny question, though,
mm-hmm.
because it could come a time where a government somewhere says, you cannot have children. Our country is too big. We don't have enough resources. And you cannot have children. We'll let you know when you can start having children again. We'll study it, but you cannot have children. That would seem to me to be anti-biblical.
I agree. I mean, this regulations trickle down from top to bottom, I think, are necessary when you think, I'm trying to evade the question, if you will, quote-unquote, kingdom of the left. But it is still first article. It is still first article. So
God created the world.
Yes. And then Martin Luther's Catechism, when he explains the first article, he talks about building a home first, house and home, wife and children. So if you don't have a house, I mean, if you follow that logic, you shouldn't be starting a family. But
okay.
if you are starting a family, you make sure that you have, this is how I get back to the point of stewardship. So we have counseling, premarital counseling, okay, talking about relationship, this and that, but sustenance. So what does family mean? What does living together mean as husband and wife? God willing, we pray that we have children. How many is a question that we need to ask? God has given us wisdom. Am I able to afford? I'm not talking about luxury. Am I able to feed my children? How many can I feed? Those are economic questions. And that means, in the words of Paulo Freire, like 35 years ago, conscientization, big word, raising human conscience. So I know who I am. My responsibility is to my fellow brother, sister, my wife, my spouse, my children, my society, community. That's the social awareness. Christianity by its very definition is holistic. It helps us see us human beings as stewards of God's creation. Stewards obviously have responsibilities. It's a privilege to be a steward of God and God's riches. And also that brings with it responsibility. In this case, going back to scripture, if I cannot take care of my own household, how dare I claim that I am the shepherd of the flock who is responsible for hundreds and hundreds of people. So that's the fundamental principle I'm trying to apply here. Again, I'm speaking as a Christian from this angle. But when the government forces certain policies onto people, they have no other means by which to effect such changes in the community. It's like government in this case acts as the police. You're really going out of bounds. We just can't let you do this anymore.
Now, do they have a reception hall over there that handle 800 people? In case you have to have a wedding over there?
There are places.
Is that right?
Yeah. There are places.
800 people?
Yeah.
You'd have to have two bands, wouldn't
right.
you?
That's right.
I don't know that one band can play for 800.
There is more than one band, and you don't sit down for 2 hours or 3 hours for dinner.
So is this wedding a hypothetical, or is this coming up?
It's realistic. I mean, I've seen it in my wife and my wedding.
But now this is a son, right?
This is a son.
So does the father of the bride have to take care of all that over there in India? So you're gonna just kick back and enjoy yourself.
This is not. My sons, very likely, all of them will get married in the United States, and they'll have 50 people come.
Ah, well.
And I was already told that, Dad, you and Mom are just guests, and we know who we will invite.
Ah, well, that's a strong American strain there.
That I did not know a year ago. I did not know. Until then, I thought, having lived in the U.S. all these years, it was my job to invite my friends. And
so did they make you happy, or were you... Or did you say, I'll tell you what, I'm going to tell you what happens at this
What? was my question. So then I cooled off.
All right. Well, when you get back from India,
We'll
have you back here and find out what it is that you saw and what it is that you learned. I look forward to that.
I will definitely come back.
That's Dr. Victor Raj. He is professor here at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Tomorrow we do the last half of Mark 12 with Pastor Mark Hawkinson. We'll have live Lenten worship for you from Peace Lutheran Church in South St. Louis County.
Listen to Chuck Rather and guests Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.